Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. Goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Mike Bolton will be telling us all about a good society. It's a political idea he's had. And Dave Roberts is a filmmaker that's written and filmed Libya. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733. But we start this week with Mike Bolton, who's had an idea called A Good Society. Now, it sounds good, Mike. What's it all about?
Right. What it's about is the fact that, in my view at any rate, we have been suffering a very long period of bad government in this country. In fact, for at least as long as I can remember, we've had bad government. Governments making decisions on the basis of policy rather than fact. Not researching what they're doing, but coming up with bright saloon bar ideas, and we're expected to live with the solutions.
So one of the ways I've heard it put is the economic cage. Apparently, even in medieval times, a serf only had to work about 4 months of the year for his lord of the manor, and he was a slave, basically, for those 4 months. Nowadays, we have to work 5 or 6 months in terms of economics to pay tax, and we're really only working the other part of the year, half the year or something, for ourselves. Most of it is going to pay taxes. And also, I mean, we've had statistics recently to say that if both couples are working in a family, both members of the couple are working, they still can't afford childcare if they're getting an average wage. So we've got a pretty disastrous situation with a massive overload of debt. So how do you propose we get out of it?
Right, the first thing is we need to overhaul the tax system. We have too many taxes. Each tax has to have its own bureaucracy to manage it, to assess people for the tax, to enforce the tax. If you replicate this across a number of taxes, you're spending more and more money merely assessing and gathering tax. Whereas if you had less taxes, you would be working far more efficiently in gathering the tax.
Okay, so which taxes, assuming we scrap all tax overnight, which ones would you keep the next day?
Right, the first one, we would go back to pre-World War One and use a land tax as the base tax.
The trouble is, of course, that people need land, don't they? I mean, everyone needs land, and it's like, why tax things which are the basic essentials of life that everybody needs? Surely we should be more thinking about taxing luxuries which people don't need. Everyone needs a home, and of course a home has to sit on land, doesn't it? I mean, for example, even an allotment.
Yeah, but what people don't realise, and this has been researched recently, is that 2/3 of the land in this country is untaxed. It's owned by a small number of people, less than 1% of the population, own that land and earn a very, very high profit from that land, yet pay little tax. In fact, many of them actually get more money in subsidies than you would believe.
This is common agricultural policy subsidies you're
talking
about, no?
This is the government, our government. I do not blame most of our problems on the EU. We've had bad government far longer than we've been in the EU.
But these subsidies are cap subsidies, aren't they?
Some of them are, but they're subsidies that you wouldn't recognise as subsidies. They take a lot of understanding, and there's a very large book called Who Owns Britain and Ireland, which goes into this.
Ah, this is Kevin Cahill's book, yeah.
That's the fella. Now, he has done a very great deal of research, and it's come, when he came to it, only half the land in Britain is even registered. We don't know for certain who owns the rest.
Most of it, of course, it only gets registered nowadays if it changes hands. And most of the big slices of land have been in the same hands
since hundreds of years,
since the Norman invasion.
Yeah.
Amazing. Okay, so a land tax you'd like. Any other forms of tax or just land?
While we're in the EU, we've got to have VAT. That is a requirement of EU membership. So, obviously, that is necessary. We would need to have some income tax, but a tax on work is the last tax we need. It increases the cost of all our goods and services, it taxes everything that we export, and it makes them all much more, much dearer, and makes us uncompetitive in the world markets. So the my strategy would be to lift the base rate of income tax year by year to until we can get rid of as much income tax as possible.
Okay, what about reforming the actual system, though? I'm talking about Parliament, the House of Lords, the Cabinet, you know, Downing Street, and also the monarchy. What about that lot?
Right. Well, let's start at the top with the monarchy. I am not a monarchist. I am not a Republican. But if I look at the people who might have had the job that Her Majesty has at the moment over the past, well, decades, I think I'll settle for Queen Elizabeth II. Thank you very much. There are lots of arguments against having a monarchy. But if you're going to get rid of a monarchy, you've got to have somebody sensible to take the place.
Okay, well, what's the difference between a monarchy and a dictatorship?
Well, theoretically, very, very little, except that we've got a constitutional monarchy, and there is very little the Queen can actually do. She theoretically can dissolve Parliament, but she can't just get up and dissolve Parliament. It is not possible for that to happen.
Okay, so what about Parliament itself and the House of Lords? Would you reform them?
Parliament, I would reform the voting system to get rid of career politicians. They are my number one target. They are, frankly, useless. Most of them are merely lobby fodder. They are undereducated for the job. All that most of them have done is they've gone to university, they've got lots and lots of nice bits of paper, but they've got a degree in politics or economics, and that's the lot. They get a job as a researcher or whatever for a politician, and they've got no experience of life. They don't know what their decisions do to us. We need people who do know those things.
So how do you do that then? How do you actually bring that about?
Right. You have a requirement which would have to start with the party that did it. Would have to, I mean, a good society would be that party as I see it. They would have to have that requirement that each person who stood as a member, as a candidate rather, would have to have, say, 20 years of work experience in what you can call a proper job. That is, working in industry, commerce, or the public services, something of that sort, but a job that the average person would recognise as a proper job. Now, another big problem is that MPs have had these big scandals about their pay. Now, why do MPs get pay rises? They're on a fixed-term contract. Now, nobody in the real world on a fixed-term contract gets pay rises. If they do, they are written in at the beginning. They don't just go swinging for a pay rise each year.
Shouldn't we be looking at actually bringing people outside Parliament up to a better standard rather than bringing MPs down to the bad standards that are outside? If you're going to reform MPs in that way, what you're saying is, well, people on the outside, a lot of them don't get the conditions that MPs get, so we're going to bring the conditions, the pay and conditions of MPs down. Surely what we do is we look outside and we bring pay and conditions outside Parliament up to higher standard, not bring down, it's almost like the lowest common denominator you're going for.
No. We're just starting talking about that one level. I believe that everybody should earn a living wage. That one of the big mistakes that Parliament has made is to subsidise low wages. This was tried at the end of the 18th century. It proved to be a total disaster. The outcome of doing that was it suppressed wages and increased taxation, and it cost more to collect the taxes than it would have cost to pay people a proper rate of pay in the first place.
Now, a lot of people point to the banksters in the City of London as the root of many of our problems. I mean, the bailout, the multi-tens of billions of pounds that were given to the banks to just keep them going, they actually just seem to have sucked all that up, and they're using it to lobby for even more power. So what would you do about them?
Well, I would not have bailed out the banks
but we're starting from here, aren't we, Mike?
Yeah. The point is that countries like Iceland and Australia put the money in at the bottom. They gave people at the bottom of the heap the money, not the bankers. The money wound up with the bankers eventually anyway, because that's the way the world works. But you make them work for their money. The big error here was that we didn't actually investigate the errors and prosecute those that are the wrongdoers in the banks. Now, I believe that it's not too late to hold that investigation and hold those people to account for their misdoings.
Okay, so you're talking about jailing them even? Because what a lot of people say is they're too big to jail.
Yeah, they're possibly too big to jail, but I don't believe that jail is the answer to all problems. This country's got something of an obsession, not quite as bad as the USA, but we have something of an obsession with putting people into prison. Prison serves one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to quarantine the bad guy from the rest of us, so we keep our kit while he stays behind some bars. Now, this brings in the question of what do you do about prison sentences? I would stop fixed-term prison sentences and have targeted sentences, that the person would stay in prison until they achieved something that was preset by the courts. For example, a standard of literacy or something of that sort, but something that would require them to work while they were in prison and actually achieve their release.
Well, that means people say with a low IQ may never get out of jail.
It would be a matter of setting realistic targets. And I don't think that a judge would have to make that decision. I think that we already have people like probation officers and people of that sort assessing people. We would need to have proper assessments by educationalists and such people to set a target that those would help those people.
Now, everyone in the past who's tried to reform society, I'm thinking particularly about people like the Levellers in the English Civil War, the Chartists in Wales and elsewhere in Britain, what they've had is a sort of quick, easy to get your head around document with a list of demands, really. And have you got something similar to that?
I have got a list of suggestions.
You're not being quite so forceful as to call them demands.
Not demands.
Very polite.
No, because I'm me, and I haven't got the power to enforce demands. What I'm hoping for is that other people will join with me and support what I'm saying, modify it slightly, so that we can move together and actually turn the suggestions into some sort of reality.
Okay, so whereabouts can people find you? I'm hoping it's not just online, because we like to try and make sure that people haven't got to get on a computer, that they can maybe pick up a phone or go around and see you.
Yep, they can certainly phone me, but the website that I have got, and I've got a Facebook page as well, is www.a-good-society.org.uk.
And you're based in Radstock, and how about phone number?
Phone number 01761 436681.
Mike Bolton, thanks very much, and I'll repeat that number if anyone's interested in having a chat to Mike to take it a bit further for a good society at the end of the show.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined now by Maggie Tuttle. Maggie's from a charity called Children Screaming to be Heard. At least that's her website. Maggie, tell us a bit about your campaign.
Well, I'm 71 now, Tony, and I was in retirement, and I couldn't believe what I had to witness of a child. And I thought, no, this can't be happening here in England. I mean, wherever you go in the world, everybody says, children are safe in England, nothing can happen to them. Well, my God, it brought me back out to campaign. And the name Children Screaming to be Heard was registered as a charity, because that's what our children are doing, screaming to be heard. The silent witnesses, which they are, and here lies the truth, because not one kid is allowed to speak. Although there's a law being passed now that kids can go into court from the age of 10. But it won't happen, Tony. Won't happen. Our kids are a multi-billion pound industry.
Okay, well, can you explain the sorts of individual cases that you deal with, and maybe go into some names as well, if you're allowed to?
No, I'm not, because there's a hell of a lot of gagging orders on families as well.
Okay, well, tell us, what sorts of cases that you're dealing with most of the time, then?
Well, there's the forced adoptions. I mean, I'll give you an instance of one case. The father, he's now in his mid-30s, married Jane, so in love, the two of them, And their first child was born 5 months ago. The child was taken away from the hospital from birth on future emotional abuse. And they're saying that because the father was in care and was abused himself, he could possibly abuse his son down the road, let's say. And so that child has been taken.
Well, surely there must be evidence that this is an abusing person, not just that they've been abused themselves.
Well, Tony, listen, I have the information where someone tried to give the lawyers evidence, and the lawyer came back and said, we are in family courts, not criminal courts. All evidence is irrelevant. That says it all for every family court. Now, I haven't finished researching this because I do a lot of research. To campaign, you see, Tony, you've got to have the evidence. And the other day, I came across this information which says the cover-up of the paedophiles, that's why we've got closed family courts. And they haven't been closed family courts for hundreds of years. It's only going back some years ago, which I'm now in the middle of researching. So it was a big cover-up. They're just taking the children and that's it.
So you're talking about from legitimate families,
yes.
Children being taken away. Whereabouts are they being placed and how?
Well, they're going into foster care. They're being adopted out. They're being trafficked, prostituted, you name it, and that's it. That's where they're going. I've been on the streets of London many, many times, Tony, the early hours of the morning, filming these kids on the streets. And there's kids, I've seen young kids as young as, I don't know if that little girl was 4 or 5, I still don't know until, but the police know what's going on, but nothing happens. And I can't say too much on the radio, on the air, but we know what's going on, the police know what's going on. The paedophiles in this country, it's now being named that Britain is the centre of the paedophiles for Europe. You've probably seen that in the press anyway.
Well, we've also seen this just this week, revelations about Rotherham. Thousands, I think it's 1,400 children abused in Rotherham in the care system. So the idea of taking children away from parents doesn't necessarily guarantee they're going to be looked after at all, does it?
They're not. They're not at all. And, I mean, I've seen it. I set up a lot of hostels in Hackney and around that way in the 80s, and all of those homeless people as well, all from the care system. When you work it out, there's 49% of prisoners from the care system. You've got thousands in the detention centres from the care system. Thousands of kids again from the care system in psychiatric units. And it goes on and on. I mean, It's just shocking what's happening.
Now, one of the things that you say, I know, in some of your campaigning literature is that you're comparing this to the Nazi Lebensraum programme. So, first of all, what was that?
Well, in actual fact, it's amazing because if I can just change slightly what we're talking about and go back to it's hormone replacement therapy, which was a drug. It's still prescribed now, but it was more so then. It was a drug. It's prescribed. It's a drug that was murdering women legally worldwide. And I blew up what was happening with hormone replacement therapy. And then I started to think, why are they messing around with women's hormones? For why? And then I did years of research into that one. And up came the Eugenics Society, which is now known as the World Population. And it came back to the Lebensborn program, which, you know this saying, in a child's best interest, that was Mr. Hitler who coined that phrase, with Mr. Himmler back in 1933, I think it was, when he formed the SS, which is now the Social Services.
Well, that's only just a coincidence, those two names. But look, getting back to Rotherham...
No, he did coin that phrase, Hitler did.
Yeah, but I'm not disputing that. It's just that social services, it's just a coincidence that that's the same as Schutzstaffel.
No, because...
And I can understand you campaigning around that idea. But anyway, back to Rotherham for a minute. And one of the spokespeople up there, he's the chief executive of Rotherham Council, Mark Kimber, has been saying this week that nobody at all has been disciplined over the failure to protect 1,400 children from sexual abuse in Rotherham.
No, they probably won't get disciplined. This has been going on for years, all this child abuse.
With all your campaigning then, do you think there's any light at the end of the tunnel here?
No. And even if the people rose up Well, until they rise up, there's going to be... There's no chance. There's not one kid in this country is safe, Tony. Not one kid. Wherever I go, in Tesco's or wherever, I hand out the cards and I say to families, do not contact social services for anything whatsoever. The biggest army in this country is the social workers, and they are a law unto themselves, and no one can bring them to account. And even Ofsted have said that.
But, well, some social workers surely do a good job, yes, as well. And how do we distinguish between the two?
We can't until there's an investigation.
And is there any kind of proper inquiry going on?
No, none whatsoever. Social workers do as they please. Most of these social workers as well, although they're getting paid and working for the social services, a lot of them have their own outside companies set up as well, so which look at companies' health.
I suppose it's a little bit like MPs and journalists. It's really a lot of abuse going on, and so all of them get tarred with that brush.
There are a lot of good foster carers and social workers, I will say, but there's too many bad ones out there. And there's no record kept of children in foster care who were being abused. How many children in foster care have died? How many children who were adopted have died? There's no records.
So how are you actually able to help people then, Maggie?
Well, because the legal aid has been taken away now, you can help them, you know, to tell them what to do and everything. I'm not a legal person, obviously, but it's the mere fact that you can talk to someone and you give them hope. And you tell them to try and fight. They have to, for themselves. And by linking people up with each other, because it's like everybody thinks they're the only one going through whatever. So you link people up. I recently had a very big conference in London, which I think you know about. Well, I also
tell
did
us about,
the M25 blockade. So
okay, tell us about your London conference, because at least it's useful, isn't it, if people can actually get together to discuss these things.
Yeah, that's right. And we had, for the first time, we had Sue Reed, journalist, spoke up.
Sonny Poulton, she's written quite a lot in the... Sue Reed is from the Daily Mail, I think, isn't she?
Yeah, that's right. She came and spoke and supported us. Michael Bailey, the barrister, he's fantastic. So we had legal people. John Hemming spoke. Joseph from
the MP. Yeah, so it sounds to me like you're able to bring some really good campaigning people in. And if you can do nothing else, Maggie, surely you can help put people in touch with trustworthy solicitors and barristers.
Well, that's another thing. That's right, yeah. But we need to do something urgently because of the legal aid system as well. I have got some ideas out there, and I've been interviewed twice by the Legal Aid Watch, it's called. So I'm trying to get something going there. But the whole system in a child's best interest is an absolute joke. It really is. And these gagging orders, I mean, there's quite a few hundred people in prison, you know, on the gagging orders.
How do they work then?
Well, the judge will gag someone and say that you are not allowed to name the case or your child. And if you do, you will go to prison. And they put a gagging order on you. I know an elderly lady who's got a gagging order, and she's been threatened with 7 years if she speaks out about her grandson.
Just tell us what's happened to her grandson.
Her grandson was taken into care.
For what reason?
Trumped up charges again, allegations. Most children are taken into care, Tony, on allegations. But yes, there are children out there who need support and to be taken into care, but not to be taken into care to be abused yet again. I mean, when a kid goes into care, they lose all contact with their families. If I go back to the early 70s, in those days, a man in prison was allowed 20 minutes a month to see his family. We've got more or less the same thing now with the children in care. They're allowed 1 hour contact every so many months with their family. I mean, we've got children allowed 4 hours a year to see the mother.
What do you think the agenda behind all this is then?
Money. It's all money and control of the population. That's why I say, going back to the hormones that I uncovered, the campaign I did there, it's all to do with... Well, you know, they say, Tony, they say, oh, we're getting overpopulated, there's not enough food, and they just go on all the time. But Really and truly, when you drive around, I mean, there's thousands of acres of land, but farmers get paid not to to grow their fruit and veg.
Maggie, whereabouts are you based and how do people contact you?
Well, I'm based in Essex.
And where's the best, how's the best place, way to people to contact you?
They can call me on the landline, or the mobile is better, actually.
Okay, can you just give us the phone numbers then?
077-677-107-56, and they can email, all one word, maggietuttle@btinternet.com.
Okay, Maggie, thanks very much.
All right, and we will give
those numbers out again at the end of the programme.
Okay, bye.
Thank you. And Maggie's website is childrenscreamingtobeheard.com. That's childrenscreamingtobeheard.com, where you'll find Maggie Tuttle and her research.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And I'm pleased to welcome Jason Yannakopoulos. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
Now, it's your last, your last show for at least a long while. You managed to get yourself a job.
Yes, finally.
Fantastic. Well done. Just remind us all, how long have you been job seeking for?
Nearly 2 years now. And that's surprising for somebody with a master's degree who also set up their own disabled students campaign.
Well, that is amazing, isn't it? And I think, fair play to you for being persistent. A lot of people have given up long ago and decided to go onto the black market. Some people have just, basically collapsed in despair with a ridiculous task. But anyhow, just to give us an idea who you'll be working for.
There's a group called Radiant Disability. They're based in Windsor. They deal with all sorts of areas of disability. In this case, I'm actually more focusing on housing, so it's all about whether the housing is appropriate, whether they're being looked after properly, whether they're happy, really.
Well,
so.
Fantastic, Jason. We're going to miss you, but, good one. Well done. And I suppose we should also remind our listeners that, one of the things we've been discussing, and also with Elia over the last year or so, is these Edward Snowden revelations about spying. There's going to be a protest up at GCHQ in Cheltenham, people from all over the country converging on the donut of these rather nasty spies that have been hacking into our computers, hacking into our phones, basically fleecing us. So, anyway, what are your thoughts about that? Are you going to be going?
Well, that'll certainly be a good event. I might pop down, you never know.
Okay. Well, let's run through some private eye. The last time we're going to do this for a long while. Hopefully you'll pop back at some point, Jason, but we're not going to be hearing from you for a long while at the least. So let's make the most of it. Right, police.
Yes, it's this is actually a disability story. Greater Manchester Police has been criticised for its sloppy approach to a young man who was known to have suffered from epilepsy, who died after suffering 3 seizures while in custody for more than 30 hours.
I don't know how anybody buys copies of Private Eye and then stays alive, because it's the sort of thing that makes you feel so depressed. Okay, another very sad story, but what have they been up to in Manchester?
Well, I don't know. To make things worse, it's the fourth time in 3 years the Independent Police Complaints Commission has castigated force for the treatment of disabled people.
How nice of them. Okay, so what's Private Eye saying about it?
Well, what happened is, in this case, a 19-year-old who's named as late Billy Stolton suffered 2 seizures while being held at Cheadle Heath Custody Suite in July 2012, which was completely unnoticed by custody staff who should have been monitoring a CCTV screen. He was later found collapsed from a third attack in the cell in Stockport's magistrate and taken to Stepping Hill Hospital, where he later died.
So, okay, so the people looking at it were supposed to, their job was to look at the custody suite and keep their eye on it, on the CCTV and the police. How long are they doing in jail, Jason?
Well, they haven't been convicted. Because okay. it's found that nobody could be held responsible.
Oh, that's handy, isn't it? Oh, dear. Well, I think maybe our justice system, we need to hit the reset button. This is the same sort of thing that happens in other parts of the world. We like to point the finger at places where police can get away with murder, like places like Bahrain. But it happens here too, it seems. Anyway, next story is about Google, the media, our great friends at Google, and News Corp, run by Rupert Murdoch.
Yes, Google and The Sun are joining forces to get kids coding, with the paper announcing that it is backing a code camp for children that's being run in Google's London's offices until the end of the summer holidays. Which is surprising, being as Rupert Murdoch's runner for hating Google. Last he replied to Twitter followers who begged him to expose Eric Schmidt of Google by promising, just wait. Even in April this year, he ridiculed Google when they made an attack on America's National Security Agency, that's the NSA, saying, Google attack on NSA, is they've got a nerve. And funnily enough, he then complains of not being an ethical company, which I think is rather ironic, coming from the man who owns a News Corp.
Okay, and the man who's in charge of phone hacking right across the world. Yes, very, very rich of to accuse Google of that. But anyway, they're both in bed together. What a horrible thought. The Tories are emulating Margaret Thatcher. Why and how are they doing that, Jason?
Well, this is two stories that appeared in Private Eye, where the Tories seem to be taking on some of Thatcher's old policies.
What is that to do with supporting apartheid, for example?
No, but George Osborne has said, has sort of go and create new products to the financial industry, which is precisely what a previous Tory government said about the personal pension reforms in the 1980s that triggered the mother of all mis-selling scandals.
Okay, so, and also things like derivatives, which were illegal before the Thatcher-Reagan era, they also created the crash, many people say as well. So the idea that the city can just dream up new ways to invest money that are more and more dodgy, I think we're asking for trouble. Do they want a crash, do you think?
Well, I think though, because I know a lot of these bankers seem to profit quite a lot from that.
Oh, they do, don't they? This is, oh, how convenient. And then everyone forgets how much money they've made out of it. So everyone loses money, apart from the bankers, who make loads of money because they have gambled in the stock markets and in the commodity exchanges. Okay, any other ways that Tories are emulating Thatcher?
Well, Meltzer's that. Another housewife. Well, the Tories' dream of a property-owning democracy is proving elusive. The questers catch on to an eye-catching populist policy in the spirit of Margaret Thatcher's right to buy, without annoying people at the Telegraph. And in an effort to do this, they've been offered three different ideas by three different people, with the Tories about to choose. One of them, the one-man think tank that is Nicholas Boyce-Smith, aka Create Streets, his idea is to knock down all social housing estates that obstruct the view across London and replace them with fine Georgian squares. A laudable idea, rather unsubtle attempt to do away with social housing forever. Alex Morton of Policy Exchange has wanted to flog off the capital's valuable social housing, which coincidentally is the bedrock of Labour's vote, advising the Prime Minister that estate regeneration could be a big idea for the Tories' election manifesto.
So both of them, what they're thinking is, well, I know, where all those houses that those Labour voters live in, let's just smash them up.
And replace them with places that Tory voters will live in. Funny that, isn't it?
Amazing. Okay, what about Rabin and Capita? Now, who is Rabin? Capita, this big company that's taking over a lot of public services and running them privately for a private profit, and we're not allowed to know anything about them because it's all covered by commercial confidentiality, basically like a secret cult taking over our government, and then also the cabinet. So how are these two related, Capita and the cabinet?
You're going to love this. Capita and the cabinet office have gone into a joint venture aiming to make project management and IT training more fun. As Private Eye, I think, rightfully says here, what could possibly go wrong?
Sounds like a disaster waiting to happen. Okay, what about Bahrain? Moving on to Bahrain, we talked about them briefly earlier. A despotic regime, supported, of course, by Her Majesty's government.
And not just that, but software sold by the Gemma Group, a company based out of Winchester, which sends malware called FinSpy to target computers and phones, thus allowing them to become a mobile spying device. A lot of their stuff has just turned up in Bahrain.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
So what's been going on? What's your theory, Jason?
Well, my theory is that the Gamma Group has sold a lot of their stuff to Bahrain, but I couldn't possibly comment.
Okay. And finally, your finally.
Well, and finally, when I was here last time, I talked about a councillor from my hometown council, the Royal Borough of Windsor and Maidenhead, Peter Lawless, being found guilty of fraud.
Good old Mr. Lawless with a perfectly appropriate name.
Yes, he has decided, he's recently announced, he's decided he will not step down as a councillor for the Royal Borough of Windsor and Maidenhead.
And why was he, just remind us, going to do that in the first place?
Well, because he'd been... Because he may be being charged with fraud.
But even so, he's a tough old nut, isn't he? Even if he's charged with fraud, he's still going to carry on as a great politician, as a great example to all the kids, man. Anyway, Jason, listen, it's been great working with you over the last few months, a year or so almost, and good luck in your new job.
Thank you, and thank you, BCFM. Bristol Community FM, 93.2.
Your voice, your choice. Hello, my name's Duncan Bambridge, and over the next few weeks I'll be taking you through some of the ideas and evidence of US creation scientist Kent Hovind. As said last week, Kent is currently in jail in the US for alleged tax evasion, and the ideas he talks about are banned in the British Free School and Academy science lessons. Whether or not they are wrong or right is not the question. Rather, should children be taught both creation and evolution to be left to make up their own minds?
Well, the two basic forms of government here. The two basic philosophies of government are evolution and creation. If evolution is true, laws come from man's opinion. And you get your rights from the government. The government decides if you have the right to travel, if you have the right to do this, all of your rights come from the government. But if creation is true, then we have inalienable rights that are endowed by the Creator. Ooh, big difference. Kids, you tell kids in school, hey, you shouldn't steal. Why not? Because God says you shouldn't steal. That's why not. But if there is no God, what are you going to tell them? Because it's not nice. Well, that won't cut it. We've lost a whole generation because of our philosophy we're giving them, folks. Yes. See, America was a constitutional republic when we started, because our founding fathers, even though they weren't all Christians, but a lot of them were Bible-believing Christians, but they had a biblical philosophy. They gave us a republic. When Ben Franklin walked out of the building, one of the ladies said, Mr. Franklin, what kind of government did you give us? He said, a republic, if you can keep it. Republics are hard to keep. We've lost ours, folks. We are not a republic anymore. We have degenerated to a democracy, and the next step is totalitarianism. We're that close to becoming a totally socialistic and then communistic country in America. You watch, it's going to happen real soon. We've become the land of the free and the home of the slave. It's happening. Charles Darwin wrote this book, it's right here, The Origin of Species, 1859. Now, that wasn't the whole title to the book. I'll show you the whole title in just a minute. Back in those days, they had long titles on their book. But they call it The Origin of Species. Now, hold it, what is a species? You know, he never does talk about the origin of species in The Origin of Species. He never does talk about it. The Bible never says they bring forth after their species. The Bible says they bring forth after their kind, right? Now, what is a kind? Well, I would say a wolf and a dog are the same kind of animal. I mean, stand back and look at it. It's not a turtle, okay? A horse and a zebra are the same kind of animal. Now, they may not be the same species, but they're the same kind. And we've never seen an animal bring forth something other than the same kind. Never seen that. But the textbooks talk about the speciation as if this is part of evolution. There was a vocabulary breakdown back in the 1800s when Darwin's book came out. They were looking for the origin of species. God never said anything about that. The origin of their kinds. That's all we've ever seen, is animals bring forth after their kind. Anyway, bees may be different species of monkeys, but they're the same kind of animal. And noticing that just because man has classified them as different species does not mean God classified them as different kinds. And it might be that each of these came from a common ancestor. I wouldn't argue about that. But it's still the same kind of animal. That doesn't prove we all came from a rock, does it? Anyway, excuse me. Here's the whole title to Darwin's book. The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or the Preservation of Favored Races. In the struggle for life. Ooh, favored races. Charlie, that's not politically correct. Well, back in the 1800s, it was. You see, back in the 1800s, nearly everybody was a racist. A lot of the advanced nations. We're going to these third world countries to try to colonize them, right? So they could steal their gold and rubies and diamonds for pay the guys a nickel a week, you know, to work for them. You have to understand the climate of the 1800s, particularly the early 1800s, when evolution became popular, before Darwin ever came on the scene. Charlie Darwin's grandpa, Erasmus Darwin, came up with everything Darwin did. Darwin never gave credit to his grandpa, by the way, but I'm sure he stole all the ideas from him. But Charlie Darwin, when his book came out in the mid-1850s, 1859, racism was popular. It was acceptable to be a racist. Today it's unacceptable. Darwin thought natives were just advanced animals. Huh. Well, that fits with the times. We had slavery in America in 1859, didn't we? Yeah. Civil War hadn't started yet. They bought and sold them like cows. Matter of fact, they packed them onto ships and brought them over here. They calculated how many they could get on the ship. They estimated that one half of them would die in the route, en route to the New World. They chained them to the deck and left them for 2 weeks. I mean, that's where they slept, that's where they ate, that's where they went to the bathroom. They didn't move, chained to the deck for 2 weeks. Half of them died. No big deal. Just like cows, throw it away, get a new one. That's the way they thought, folks. What's the matter with these people? Well, the problem is their philosophy. They think these people are inferior, and you always act according to your belief. What you believe is extremely important. But be careful what philosophy you have. Man, if your slave gets out of line, beat him. If he dies, oh well, go buy another one, right? Wasn't that the attitude? That these people are inferior? By the way, that's still the attitude of some groups today in America, like the KKK. I met a fellow from the KKK one time. We got talking about, I had a bus route in an all-black neighborhood, brought kids to church, had a wonderful time, very friendly folks, get invited in. I mean, 17 years I drove a bus, church bus in a black neighborhood. Great, great ministry. This fellow from the KKK told me, black people don't have souls. He told me that to my face. I don't know if they all believe that, but that fellow did. Racism was prevalent during the mid-1800s, and when Darwin's book came out, at last, a scientific justification for what we've been doing already. Sold all 1,200 copies in the first day, first printing. There might have been a cover-up there. They think maybe one guy arranged to have them all bought so it would look like a runaway bestseller, but anyway, they did sell them all the first day, 1,200 copies. Had to reprint it. Racism was popular. Darwin also thought women were inferior. Charlie Darwin said, a married man is a poor slave, worse than a Negro. If a professor said that today in your local university, how long would he keep his job? Or his life? And yet Darwin is considered one of the saints, isn't he? He was a racist and a chauvinist. By the way, he finally married his first cousin, Emma Wedgwood. Nobody else would marry him. Would you marry this guy? Strange man. These two folks had an interesting job. Back about the turn of the century back here, between 1800 and 1900, Darwin's theory had become very popular. 1859, the book came out, and many people began pushing it and promoting it. Thomas Huxley and, I mean, lots of folks were pushing this evolution theory. And it kind of took over the world in the next 20 years. The world was ready for it anyway. They were looking for a way to get rid of God. There was the right climate when Darwin came along. But Darwin said, we should find thousands and millions of missing links. Well, they couldn't find any. So it became very popular to look for missing links. These two folks went to Australia, and they got the Australian Aborigines and said, you know what, that looks like a missing link. Their jaws are bigger. Well, the reason their jaws are bigger is because the Aborigines don't use hardly any tools, and they use their jaws like a vise to clamp down on stuff. When they want to strip the bark off a tree branch, they clamp on it and pull the bark off. You use your jaw muscles a lot like that. The muscle pulls on the bone responds by getting bigger. Any bodybuilder will tell you, the more you build your muscles, the bigger the bones get. So the Aborigines have big jaw bones because they use their jaws a lot. That's why. But these guys thought, no, they're a missing link. So they went down to, the whole article's right here, published in Creation Magazine, Creation X and Hilo. This is the 1992 March to May edition, about what happened to the people in Australia, the Aborigines, Darwin's body snatchers. They went down and began robbing the graves of the Aborigines because they could sell the bones as museum displays. Pretty soon they ran out of graves to rob, so they started shooting the Aborigines. They rounded them up and shot them. The police were involved in this. A missionary, a New South Wales missionary, was the horrified witness to the slaughter by mounted police of a group of dozens of Aborigines, men, women, and children. 45 heads were then boiled down and the best 10 skulls packed off for overseas. Here's the article right here. Shot them, cut their heads off, boiled them down, and sold the bones. Why? Well, the Smithsonian was buying a bunch of them. They have 33,000 in their basement right now. You could make big money. If you had a human skull that looked slightly deformed for some reason, man, it'll sell big.
In a statement released today, scientists have announced that based on their research, they have concluded that God is a myth.
And that was God's Not Dead, soundtrack for the movie 2014 by the Newsboys.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Here's a one-man tribute to himself and the world. Jeff Sparks, what's on this week?
Thank you, Tony. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 29th of August, Cloudbustin, who performed the music of Kate Bush, will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews at Bristol. Tickets are £8 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on 29th of August, Burning Memories will be performing with support from Fires, Dead Romantics and also Goodbye the Sunset at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Johnny Cash. He is one of the most influential musicians of the 20th century, and in a career that spanned almost 50 years, he has released around 50 studio albums, several live albums, and numerous compilation albums. This is from Man in Black, the very best of Johnny Cash, and it's the song Big River.
Now I taught the weeping willow how to cry, and I showed the clouds how to cover up a clear blue sky. And the tears that I cried for that woman are gonna flood you, big river, and I'm gonna sit right here until I die. I met her accidentally in St. Paul, Minnesota, and it tore me up every time I heard her drawl, southern drawl. Then I heard my dream went back downstream, cavorting in Davenport, and I followed you, big river, when you call. Then you took me to St. Louis, later on down the river. A freighter said she's been here, but she's gone, boy, she's gone. I found her trail in Memphis, but she just walked up the bluff. She raised a few eyebrows and then she went on down alone. Now won't you bat it down by Baton Rouge, River Queen, roll it on. Take that woman on down to New Orleans, New Orleans. Go on, I've had enough, dump my blues down in a gulf. She loves you, big river, more than me. Now I taught to weeping willow how to cry, 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 and I showed the clouds how to cover up a clear blue sky, and the tears that I cried for that woman are gonna flood you, big river, and I'm gonna sit right here until I die.
That was Johnny Cash with Big River from the compilation album Man in Black, the very best of Johnny Cash. Into Saturday, 30th of August, the Black Sabbath tribute at Snowblind will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. Entry is free and the gig starts around 9:30 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 31st of August, Goodnight Harvey will be performing with support from In My Vanity and Into the Shade at the Exchange in Old Market, Bristol. Tickets are £5 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
That's all for this week. Dialects, Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, and is on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. Thanks to our guests, Mike Bolton from A Good Society. His number again, 01761 436681. Also to Maggie Tuttle from Children Screaming to be Heard. She's on 07767 710756. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. So that was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, off for a couple of weeks. Wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now. That.